Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Silas and he is the creator of Premed. He's a paramedic or a crit care paramedic here in the UK, and we're going to talk today about ECGs and particularly talking about sort of a stepwise approach towards it, what we're using it for in the pre-hospital environment. And also then be going into how we sort of communicate a PPCI referral and sort of the challenges that might be faced during that time when you are sort of stressed out doing that for potentially even the first time. So thanks for jumping on today, Silas. Do you want to go through a bit about yourself and a bit about Premed and what you guys do?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be on. So as you said, my name's Silas. I'm a critical care HEMS paramedic currently. So I've been qualified just around 8 years. Spent a bit of time as a paramedic, was a team leader for a while. Then I did a postgrad in critical care, worked on the road as a critical care paramedic, which is my main job. But I'm currently seconded to my local air ambulance, which is Kent, Surrey, Sussex Air Ambulance, if people feel like donating money. So I'm there for 2 years as a HEMS paramedic. And alongside that, as you said, I kind of founded Premed, which is a company, stands for Pre-Hospital Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine Education. And initially we started with face-to-face courses, and then COVID happened and everything had to change, of course. And so we went into webinars predominantly, and now we've moved into e-learning. So our first e-learning course is published, and that is on ECGs, pertinent to this discussion. And so that's called the Pre-Hospital and Emergency Department ECG course, which is a four-part ECG course designed for anyone from the real basics, kind of first, second year students, all the way through to advanced practice clinicians and probably middle grade doctors. And as it says on the tin, it's for pre-hospital and emergency medicine ECG interpretation. And I guess pertinent to that, I have a diploma in ECG interpretation. So hopefully I know a bit about ECGs, but maybe not the whole lot.
Well, we'll find out now, won't we? So that's fantastic. So we'll jump in, I guess. So we'll start off with, why do we even use an ECG? When are we going to apply it in, particularly in the pre-hospital environment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think ECGs is an interesting one because obviously in emergency medicine, those that have worked there, or, you know, we take patients into ED all the time, we know that there's a lot of tests and diagnostic investigations they use to come to a diagnosis. And so the medical model in kind of textbook application is you see a patient, you do some observations or vital signs to make sure they're not really sick. Then you take a medical history, do a kind of comprehensive systems-based patient assessment. And by doing that, you formulate a list of differential diagnoses. And I was trying to think of maybe four or five differentials for the presentation. And then you use diagnostic tests to rule in or rule out those differentials, or at least kind of structure them in terms of their likelihood in your mind. And those tests can be anything from blood tests to x-rays, CT scans, and of course, ECGs. And then once those, once you have the results of those tests and you've kind of worked out which is your most likely differential, that's the diagnosis that we go on to treat. And that's the standard medical model. And the interesting thing in pre-hospital care is the ECG is about the only medical test that we have, certainly in standard paramedic practice. Some advanced paramedics use ultrasounds. And on HEMS, for instance, we can do pre-hospital lactate monitoring. But it's only really in more rare kind of advanced practice circumstances that there are any other tests that we really use. And so the ECG becomes really important in that context. It's essentially the only medical diagnostic test that we have in practice outside our just normal assessment. So it's especially important for ambulance staff or pre-hospital staff for that reason. The question of when it is appropriate to do an ECG is a really interesting one. Let me throw that back to you and ask not when you think necessarily you should do one, but when do you think it's normally done in practice?
As in, when do I think other people doing it, or just as personal, when would I do it?
Yeah, maybe a bit of both. Just your experience of when an ECG is normally done.
Yeah.
So in the patient presentation, at what point?
At what point? So I know, well, I guess obviously you've got chest pain. So within the first 10 minutes, you're wanting to get that ECG on. Personally, whenever I'm treating people, if there's any sort of syncope of loss of consciousness or like dizziness, I generally will do one. My one is as well the elusive sort of like shortness of breath. Generally, if there's no sort of clinical reasoning for them to be short of breath, you know, they don't have a chest infection or something that is really obvious, generally we'll do a 12 lead ECG. Any sort of particular toxicology or overdose that may impact cardiac function, any electrolyte imbalances, so particularly like your renal patients, and obviously, yeah, the main one being that chest pain, particularly it either being myocardial ischemia or potentially even that PE, you know, trying to differentiate, is this pleuritic or cardiac?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's good. And that's a really interesting way that you've expressed that, because ultimately it says two things. One thing is that most patients get an ECG, and that's sort of the first stumbling block that I see in practice. And the other is that, and it sort of comes on from that, and the other thing is that patients should get an ECG for a specific reason. And so if we take the first point, everyone gets an ECG. The problem with that is that people, certainly like students as well, will see that in practice and maybe not kind of reflect on that completely. And so you'll just see everyone gets an ECG. So it just becomes a standard part of, we'll do a full set of obs and an ECG normally. And the problem with that is when you do a full set of vital signs or observations, in terms of diagnostics, it's not a specific assessment. It's sort of a screening assessment, as in you don't really care what the presentation is. Everyone gets a set of obs because they'll tell you if the patient's quite sick or not very sick, and you can move on regardless of the history. So ECGs are subtly different in that they are a diagnostic test. And so pre-test probability is really important. And that's where, as you mentioned, the different reasons comes into play. So if someone's got chest pain, for example, that's a classic one, isn't it? Chest pain, and maybe they're a bit sweaty. And then you find out in their history that they've got family history of coronary artery disease, or they've had an MI in the past, or, you know, whatever. Their pre-test probability, as in pre-ECG probability, is very high for an occlusion, but it's probably quite low for an electrolyte imbalance. And so you do the ECG essentially really looking for ST changes. But on the other hand, if you go to a renal patient who's missed dialysis and they're a bit breathless, but they're otherwise quite fit and healthy, no significant cardiac history, no chest pain, and you do an ECG, then their pre-test probability of hyperkalemia, for example, is very high, but their pre-test probability for ischemia is quite low. And so when you do the ECG, you should be really looking for T-wave abnormalities associated with hyperkalemia or other electrolyte-type ECG changes, but not particularly interested in ST elevation specifically, almost to the point where if that person has ST elevation, you don't really care because you're looking for peak T-waves. Do you see what I mean? So I think that's the stumbling block that a lot of people have, certainly new to being a paramedic, is everyone gets an ECG, and then you look at the, and because your crewmate normally does the ECG, and then you look at it whilst you consider the obs, and then before you know it, you're looking at ST elevation and starting to think if this person's having an MI or not, when you haven't actually got a comprehensive history of what's led to this point. So it's really important to consider, as you mentioned, the presentation and why you're doing the ECG. Is it for chest pain? Is it for breathlessness that might be a PE? Is it for a toxidrome? Is it for renal failure? Because depending on what your pre-test probability is or what you're doing the ECG for, really impacts what you should be looking for when it's done, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And equally, I guess, too, that reasoning as well is really important, like you said, because even, for example, you might consider the diabetic person that looks really sweaty, doesn't say they have any chest, you know, denies any chest pain, but, you know about things like silent MIs and things like that. So I guess in your sort of, well, my understanding from what you're saying as well is just having that reasoning about why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And it sort of slots in. You know, as you spend more time with the patient, you get more of an idea of what you think is happening. And I'll try and consciously now think about the underlying physiology or pathophysiology that might lead them to be the way they are. And so obviously when you first meet a patient, when you first walk into the house, you don't really know what that is. So you might have a sweaty patient with diabetes. It could be a hyper, it could be a silent MI. But as you do the observations and do an assessment, and you know, maybe they're not very confused, but their blood pressure is a bit low, which doesn't really sound very hypo-y, and so you start to understand a bit more about what's going on. And as you're starting to formulate that differential is when the ECG should really come in to give you a hard, relatively hard yes or no in one direction. And before I forget, the other thing you mentioned that's important is the ECG in the first 10 minutes thing. So that is the only, I guess, my approach is that if we apply the medical model properly, what we should do is we should walk into a patient's house, introduce ourselves, do a set of obs to make sure they're not really sick and don't need immediate resuscitation. Then we should ask them for medical history. Then we should do a hands-on patient assessment, and then we should do an ECG. So the caveat to that is that the 10-minute thing, as you said, is the European Society of Cardiology recommend that patients with myocardial ischemia get an ECG within 10 minutes of seeing a healthcare professional. And so what that says to me is not that you should prioritize ECG over the other stuff. It just means you've got a bit of a deadline in terms of getting the other stuff done. But that's the recommendation for patients with ischemia, not necessarily the recommendation for patients with toxidromes or whatever else, although obviously it's sensible to apply that. So I think in practice, yes, try and get the ECG on in the first 10 minutes, but don't let that overtake introductions, getting a rapport, doing the hands-on assessment and everything else, because otherwise you can sort of lead yourself down a bit of a rabbit hole, maybe in the wrong direction.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess now that we know, you know, when to do the ECG, how to incorporate it into our clinical assessment, I guess now we can go into the sort of the basics of the ECG. And I guess we can start off with, you know, what does the ECG show us in terms of when we're interpreting it? So, you know, when we're trying to break down that ECG, like what are we looking at? What's the underlying physiology of our PQRST, you know, waveform that we are seeing?
Yeah. And so I know we've mentioned it already, but we've got an e-learning course, and the first module of this e-learning course is literally all about this. So it goes in much more in depth if people want to look at it. But essentially, I think the important thing to remember in this context is that the ECG is a purely electrical test. And if, you know, most of the time in ambulance practice or paramedic practice, certainly, what people are looking for is ischemia, which is a plumbing problem, essentially. And so immediately, we're not looking at the problem with an ECG. We're looking at a surrogate marker of a plumbing problem. It's similar to if you have a problem with your plumbing in your house and that causes an issue with the boiler, all we really do is looking at the boiler and trying to work out which radiator is broken in the house. And for that reason, it's not completely accurate. And so changes might be different with certain people, and some people might just not have changes at all, despite quite a significant plumbing problem. But in terms of what we're looking at then, so the basic cardiac function is, so you have your myocardium, which is the muscle of the heart. And as with any cells in the body or muscle cells in the body, they need an electrical stimulus to contract. And this is the same can be said of the myocardium. To create that electrical stimulus, the cells need to create energy in the form of ATP. And to create ATP, they need oxygen as a vital component in that process. And so to get oxygen to the cells for them to create energy to then contract, they need a supply of oxygen in the blood, which is provided by the circulatory system, but specifically the coronary arteries. So when the left ventricle ejects blood out into the body, there's little openings at the base of the aorta called the ostia. And from those openings come the coronary arteries. And so blood flows through those to deliver oxygen to the heart itself. And so whilst the heart is beating, it's also supplying itself with blood and oxygen. And so the cells contract, and they contract in a fairly uniform way in normal physiology. And so the first thing that happens is the atria contract, and the terms contraction and depolarization are sort of synonymous, as well as relaxation and repolarization. And the reason that is because when the cells depolarize, it's sort of like a battery. If you depolarize a battery, then they create energy and contract. So depolarization causes a contraction, and then repolarization is the relaxation phase. And so that all starts with the SA node, which sits at the top of the atria. It releases a flow of electricity, causes the atria to contract, and actually, as long as we're standing up, that only really contributes about 20% or something of blood flow from the atria to the ventricles. The majority of that happens from gravitational force. The blood essentially just falls into the ventricles. But that happens, and that's what, when we see the P wave, which is that flow of electricity across the atria. Then you get a kind of flat line, which is the PR interval, and is commonly mistaken as a time when the AV node is holding electrical charge and stopping it from going to the ventricles. Actually, the reason it's flat is because the electricity is going through the atria and then the bundle of His and the bundle branches below it. And so it's spreading through that network of sort of specialized cells. But because it's spreading through that network of cells and not through the bulk of the myocardium, the electrical activity, although it is there, is too minuscule for the normal ECG to see. And so we just see a flat line, which is the PR interval. And then we get this QRS complex, which looks different depending on what lead you're looking at. And that's basically the different, that's the energy traveling through the ventricles in various different directions, causing the ventricles to contract. And in normal physiology, it causes them to contract in quite a specific way. So from the apex, as in the bottom of the ventricles, sort of squeezing up, which forces the blood out in quite a uniform fashion. And that's the QRS complex. And then the last thing we see is the T wave, which is the ventricles repolarizing and resetting for the next contraction.
Fantastic. I think that's one of the best, you know, and most simple explanations. It's fantastic. So hopefully everyone listening understands all that, because it was a great explanation. Now, obviously now you've talked about how the cardiac cycle works and sort of what we see on the ECG as a result of that. So I guess then let's go into interpreting our ECG then, or starting off with that, you know, breaking down that ECG.
Yeah. So interpretation is an interesting one. What you find is, I think everything is interesting because I think ECGs are interesting. Not everyone agrees with me. But the way we interpret ECGs, I think, is interesting, because another thing you see in practice is that people get an ECG, especially people that haven't been taught how to interpret them properly. And teaching does vary amongst institutions, as I'm sure we've all experienced. But people will grab an ECG and they'll either look for things they know to look for, or, you know, or they just read the thing at the top, but they don't really have a uniform way of approaching it. And you can really get yourself sort of stuck by doing that, especially as we spoke about before. If the only thing you've been taught about ECGs is looking for ST changes, and then you're looking at the ECG of someone with renal failure, and you're just looking for that, is it sort of meaningless? And ultimately, it could mean you go down a wrong treatment pathway and stuff. And so the analogy I always think about is if you go, if we went to an unconscious patient or unconscious trauma, or, you know, someone that's quite sick, we all know immediately that the way to assess them is for an A, B, C, D approach. And the reason that approach has survived throughout medical history is because it is in order of importance. So an airway occlusion will kill you quicker than ventilatory failure. Ventilatory failure kill you quicker than circulatory failure normally. Circulatory failure a bit quicker than neurological problem, and so forth. And so we address problems in the order of priority in terms of how quickly they'll ultimately kill a patient. And so ECG interpretation should really be systematic in the same way. And so, again, another plug, we at Premed, we've developed an ECG interpretation card, which is based on a structured assessment, which is it's a bit more in depth, but essentially rate, rhythm, intervals, axis, hypertrophic changes, and then infarct. And that's because, and so here's a question that should highlight it quite well. If a patient has an MI and they have a cardiac arrest, what is the thing that put them in cardiac arrest?
Well, the lack of blood flow, hence, like, then obviously no oxygen, heart stops, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and what causes enough. The lack of blood flow?
Because, like, obviously the heart's dying, so it then is unable to contract as it should do.
Yes, correct. So the problem is either a rate or a rhythm problem normally. So a rate problem might be that they're going to VT, and then the reason they go into cardiac arrest is because they're so tachycardic that the heart can't refill during its relaxation phase. And then if it's not full, it's got nothing to pump out. And so no blood goes into the coronary arteries and none to the brain. And then you go into cardiac arrest. If they go into VF, similar sort of problem. It's just not ejecting blood because there's no organized contraction. And even something like PEA or asystole, the rate has stopped pumping. And so the rate stopped. So ultimately what kills people from an MI is not ischemia, which is the last thing to look for. It is a rate or rhythm problem. And so if you go to a patient that's got some chest pain and they're sweaty and they look really sick, the first thing to look for in the ECG is not ST changes, because there's no point, it doesn't matter at the point someone needs resuscitating in front of you. If they're really hypotensive and they need intervention, the thing to look for immediately is rates or rhythm changes, which is why it's first in terms of a systematic approach. So if they're really bradycardic to the point they're passing out, they need atropine and or pacing or adrenaline or something to stabilize them enough to get them to PPCI to deal with the ischemic problem. Similarly, if they are too tachycardic and they're not getting enough time in relaxation phase to refill, and therefore they're shocked for that reason, they might need cardioversion or, you know, some sort of intervention to stabilize them so they're safe to take to PPCI. Because ultimately, the MI itself, the cardiac ischemia, doesn't lead people to die outside of the context of rate and rhythm problems. What it leads to is progressively worsening heart failure, which leads to a really poor quality of life if it gets really bad. But actually only about 5% of MIs have a sudden cardiac arrhythmia. So the thing to look for then in terms of your systematic approach is first rate, rhythm, because they're the most important things. And then we look at intervals, because if the patient's bradycardic and they don't need immediate intervention, you can start to look at why they're bradycardic. And the intervals will tell you that whether it's a block or a sinus bradycardia or whatever kind of bradycardia. And that can tell you a bit more about what interventions they need, as well as get a bit of a better understanding of what's causing it. So a bit of a diagnostic thing. And then from intervals, so rate rhythm intervals, axis becomes important. And so if they've got a normal axis, fine. If they've got a left axis or a right axis deviation, it can tell you a bit about blocks or hypertrophic changes. So if they've got left ventricular hypertrophy, for example, they might have a left axis deviation and really tall complexes, so really high amplitudes. And then if you know, if we take that example forward, once you know that, and then you're looking for ischemic changes and they've got ST elevation, but actually they don't have chest pain, or that their pretest probability of MI was actually quite low, it might be that the ST elevation is due to the left ventricular hypertrophy, which is a normal kind of change that occurs with that. And so you don't get caught in that rabbit hole by doing that systematic approach. So yeah, to summarize, rate, rhythm, intervals, axis, hypertrophy, infarct. And there's a lot of examples we could use to explain why that is useful, but probably don't have the time and it'll bore people, I think.
That's all right. And I mean, that's the thing, they can go towards your ECG Essentials course anyway, and go into more depth about it. And I think obviously we could go into more depth about it, but we also don't have the visual component, which is a really important part of understanding ECGs. Because I'm a visual learner, I have to have both.
I think that's the thing, but I think the main thing to take away from it is a systematic approach. And obviously I'd advocate the one that we made because we made it, but there's plenty of other systematic approaches if you look online. And ultimately they all recommend the same thing for the same logic that we've discussed. But the main takeaway point I'd say is to use a systematic approach, not a pattern recognition one. There's maybe one or two times when pattern recognition is useful, but pretty much never.
Well, that's an important part of all pre-hospital, like you said, and that's something that's constantly brought up amongst heaps of guests, is having a systematic approach. And it reduces that cognitive overload that you may have when you are, say, new to ECGs and you're new to the job or unsure about a particular case, and you have a systematic approach that works. If you're constantly doing it on every single ECG, it just becomes habit of doing it in that systematic way, and that way, you know, you reduce your risk of errors and cognitive overload.
Yeah, and I think it also helps you justify in your own mind why you might not get to the point of diagnosing an MI, for example, because, you know, if someone's, as a CCP, we normally back people up, you know, like we're normally second on scene to these, to sick patients. And I'd be far more interested in, if a newly qualified paramedic went to someone that was quite unwell and they recognised that they were like really bradycardic or really tachycardic, and then they requested a CCP and then they spent their time getting vascular access, giving some fluids, atropine, whatever. And I got there and they hadn't realised the patient was bradycardic because they're having a massive MI. I'd much rather that way around than they're diagnosed an inferior STEMI and the patient was flat out on the floor. Because ultimately, as I said before, the cause of that bradycardia doesn't really matter in the moment. You have to resuscitate the patient to the point they're perfusing their brain and so they're safe. And then you can diagnose the problem and take them to the right place. But there's no point turning up to PPCI with an unconscious patient who's not perfusing their brain, because it's not optimizing that patient's outcome. And so it prioritizes that. And as I say, it kind of hopefully helps you justify in your head why a CCP might turn up and say, oh, they're having an MI. And you're like, oh, I didn't really realize that at the time, because you're prioritizing stuff appropriately.
Yeah, absolutely. So heading into now, so we've had the basic sort of we've had the breakdown of ECG, we've broken it down into the systematic approach. You know, potentially you have found an ischemic event, the patient is having, say, a STEMI. You are referring them to PPCI, and obviously PPCI is different between, say, Australia and the UK to the US, in terms of how you do that, and between policies, between different sort of trusts that you work in. But like you said at the start, or like we said off air prior, there are some challenges that come along with PPCI referrals. Did you want to go through more about that and give some strategies to assist with that?
Yeah, so I guess it depends on, as you say, where you are geographically and the service you're in and the relationships your service has with the local hospitals, as well as not even just services, but even specific local areas, I would say. And it can get political. I think the thing to take away from it, and so when I was newly qualified, confident, but probably not that competent, I used to get really annoyed when PPCI would refuse a case or to tell me to go to a local A&E and not come to them, or, you know, I thought they were being difficult and didn't really understand the bigger picture. And so, but now I probably do a bit better. And so I think there's a few things that are important. One is that the European Society of Cardiology, which is the basis for RESUS Council guidelines and things in the context of MIs and ECG interpretation. So they recommend that certain criteria, which are, as you mentioned, ST changes, acute, like new onset left or right bundle branch block in symptomatic patients, essentially go direct to cath lab. But there's time constraints around that. So I think they recommend 120 minutes from the first ECG to cannulation of the artery or something along those lines. And that in itself is based on the evidence that after 2 hours, thrombolysis is probably better than primary PCI. And so it becomes very complex in that regard. But then they caveat that with a recommendation that trusts should develop protocols to achieve that recommendation. So it's not that individuals should off their own back make decisions and try and refer to people, because you wouldn't get a quality of access to healthcare for everyone. And it would be very much dependent on whether you've got an ECG interested person going to your MI or someone that's not particularly interested in ECGs. And also, really importantly, in the current NHS, like bed space is a big issue. So if a patient needs to be anaesthetized for their PCI, they will need an ICU bed after that. Or even more relevant, I suppose, if the people, like my local cath lab has 2 theatre rooms for procedures, and if they're both having, if they've got a patient in each having a PCI, then that has to be taken into consideration. And so in that context, it might be better to go to A&E at that hospital, because they'll get better all-round care whilst they're waiting for the theatre to become available. So there's a lot of reasons why PPCI might say yes or no. I think the other thing to remember is that no one kind of comes to work to be difficult, or very few people do. And so whilst we get a lot working with different agencies and different trusts, especially when we're not having face-to-face conversations, people can get really annoyed with each other because lots of communication difficulties. But the thing to remember with all of that is that everyone's turned up to work to provide the best care they can within the constraints that they're able to. And I guess what I'm coming on to is ultimately, and I don't know what your system's like, but most places will have a system where ambulance service gets either a positive or negative ECG according to really specific criteria, normally ST elevation, and they can either activate the cath lab or not. Maybe they need permission or they don't. And so there's these specific steps you go through to take a patient straight to PPCI. The complication is when they meet all of the ambulance service criteria and then the consultant says no on the phone, or they don't meet all the criteria, but you actually think they're having an MI regardless, and then you try and sell it to the consultant separately. And so, unfortunately, when people write protocols and guidelines, I'm sure they anticipate that, but it's not written into the guidelines that these things happen. They're generally a binary process. But as we know, in reality, there's no such thing as binary in medicine, really. And so there's always these grey areas. And so I guess I don't know what you want to go into. We can go into specific issues, but I think my main takeaway is that you want to follow that protocol, but with a couple of caveats. One is that if they say no, I would say the approach there is to politely ask why not, because ultimately you're still advocating for the patient. So a flat no is probably not appropriate to accept if they've met all of the criteria for that referral. But if you ask for a reason and it's a justifiable one, then you can document that and take them to the next best place. And similarly, or on the other side, I suppose, if the patient doesn't meet all of that criteria in the guideline, but you still think they're having an MI, again, to advocate for that patient, you can probably try and sell that person, in inverted commas, to the PPCI centre. And again, that would follow the same process in most places. You just have to be very aware that you're kind of outside of your trust guidelines. And so careful documentation of that conversation and reasoning on both sides is important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great, I think, summation, because obviously things are done differently between trusts and between countries. So I think having that in the back of your mind when going to these patients and making those referrals is really important. Now, I didn't want today's episode to be overloaded with too much information, because obviously EKGs or ECGs, wherever you are in the world, can be challenging to understand, and didn't want to make this too overwhelming. But I think that's a great sort of introduction to ECGs and understanding those, systematic approach to interpreting the ECG. And then also some of the challenges you may face and what to do in a PPCI referral. But before we finalize on anything, is there anything you want to go through that you think we've missed that's really important when it comes to EKGs or ECGs, and also just your assessment with them in general?
I think we discussed most things, haven't we? So when to do them, systematic approach. I think, I don't know, the thing that we've discussed is that some people are interested in them, some aren't, and so that's absolutely fine. What I'd say is, if for most people, actually, especially students, having some sort of written checklist. So as I said, we've made a thing, but I'm not necessarily saying you should definitely go and buy ours. There's plenty of things online, and there's a lot of free resources as well. So even if you make your own sort of pocket card and it has a systematic approach, then trying to apply that to every ECG and come up with a diagnosis is useful. Whether that's in practice with a patient who's hemodynamically stable and you have the time to do that, or whether you take a patient to hospital because they're a bit sick, and then you keep the ECG and you review it after the case, for example. It's really useful to just consistently apply that systematic approach, because, as you said before, the more you do it, the more you kind of do it automatically, and the more you'll gain from it. And I think coupled with that, it's patient follow-up is really important, and it's a whole can of worms to go into in any real detail because of various trust legal processes and sharing of data. But ultimately, if you don't close the loop on what's happening with the patient, you basically never know if you're all right. And so the best way, the most legal way to get patient follow-up is just go and ask the patient yourself. And ECGs, obviously a cardiac arrest or a brain injury or something, that's difficult. But ECGs, most of the time, patients stay conscious throughout their hospital journey. And so I find that's a useful thing to try and build into your practice. You know, if you regularly go back to the same emergency department, then once you've handed the patient over in the middle of the day, maybe go and find the patient you brought in earlier and ask them if they wouldn't mind telling you a bit about what's happened, or if they would consent to you chatting to the nurses or doctors about their blood tests and stuff. And that can really help close the loop on if you thought it was hyperkalemia and it turns out it was. That's useful learning. If it turns out it was something else, that can trigger a conversation with the doctor or the nurse that's treating them, and you can get a lot of learning from that. But if you don't close the loop, you can end up in a bit of an echo chamber where you think you're really good at recognizing ST elevation, but actually your hit rate is really poor. So I think that's important.
Just to finalize on where can people find out more about yourself, pre-med, and the courses you do?
So our website is www.prem-ed.com. And on there is all our e-learning is on that website. You can access our webinars through a link on the website as well. And across the top, there's a tab for our shop page as well. And so we've got that ECG interpretation card and then a few other kind of prompt cards and things that are relevant to ambulance stuff. So check it out. And as I said to you before, there's a discount code for all your listeners, which is TSPP23. And that will work on our website and at the shop, and that's 20% off.
Thank you so much. That is fantastic. And I really do hope that all of our listeners who are really interested in learning more about ECGs and improving their systematic approach with it, do check out your resources because obviously it's fantastic. So I hope that they jump on board with that. And thank you so much for taking time out of your day to jump on and have a chat about ECGs and sort of break some of the myths about how scary they can be and giving us a nice systematic way of interpreting them.
No worries. Thanks for having me. It's been good.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.